101.9 FM, featuring a mix of big-name acts and some local faves as well. On March 8th, Montreal punks the Anti-Queens hit the stage in celebration of International Women's Day. Then, on March 14th, don't miss Kingston's good times supergroup, Rocket Surgery. On March 16th, the Great Big Sale Sean McCain hits the spire and the Lahore is ready to the stage on St. Patrick's Day. On March 20th, the Cancer Bats return to town, and on March 22nd, Canadian pop sensation and Queens alum Devin Cole puts on a show. And on March 29th, don't miss the sweet sounds of Dom Lewis. Unless noted, all KPP shows co-presented by CFRC 101.9 FM take place at the Broom Factory. For full info and tickets, visit kppconcerts.com.
From New York, this is Democracy Now! About 100 protesters were arrested Thursday at Trump Tower in an action organized by Jewish Voice for Peace to call for the release of Columbia University student protest leader Mahmoud Khalil, who remains in ICE detention for organizing the Gaza Solidarity Encampment at Columbia. We'll air a report from Trump Tower, where Trump first announced his candidacy in 2015. We'll be on the very same escalators. Then we speak to the Russian-American writer M. Gessen, who's spent decades writing about autocracy. We'll talk about Trump's targeting of critics, the rollback of LGBTQ rights, the war in Ukraine, and more. Plus, we talk to a former federal judge about President Trump's escalating attacks on judges who rule against him.
The day you're not allowed to look for theft and fraud, etc., then we don't have much of a country. So no judge should be, frankly, be allowed to make that kind of a decision.
All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. Two federal judges, one in California, one in Maryland, on Thursday ordered 19 federal agencies to rehire some 20,000 probationary workers who'd recently been fired as part of President Trump and Elon Musk's massive government layoffs. The pair have also been blocked from further axing those agencies, including the Education Department, which announced this week it was reducing its workforce by roughly one half. The measures provide some temporary relief as labor groups, Democratic attorneys general, and others challenge the White House's attempt to dismantle the federal government. Separately, on Thursday, another federal judge ordered Elon Musk and a so-called Department of Government Efficiency to hand over documents related to DOGE's operations. The case was brought by 14 Democratic attorneys general and argues DOGE has been unconstitutionally ordering the mass federal layoffs. In a surprise turnabout, Senate Minority Leader Chuck Schumer announced he's voting for a Republican measure to keep the government funded, splitting from the majority of the Democratic caucus, which had been poised to block the bill. Schumer argued that letting the government shut down would cause even more harm to people and give free rein to President Trump and Elon Musk to further dismantle federal agencies. Most Democrats say the continuing resolution would also be a blank check for the White House and will defund essential food, education, and health care programs. It's not clear yet which other Democrats will support Schumer's move other than Senator John Fetterman, who had already announced he would vote in favor of the funding package. At least eight Democrats need to back the measure alongside Republicans for it to pass. The news left many House Democrats incensed, including New York Congressmember Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, who's been calling on her supporters to ramp up public pressure on Democrats to vote down the bill. She addressed reporters from a Democratic policy retreat in Leesburg, Virginia.
Just to see Senate Democrats even consider acquiescing to Elon Musk, I think it is a huge slap in the face, and I think that there's a wide sense of betrayal.
Meanwhile, young students, parents, and teachers from D.C. schools rallied at Senate offices Thursday to speak out against the spending measure, which they warn will trigger a devastating $1 billion cut to education and their services in the Capitol. Here in New York, police arrested some 100 protesters as the group Jewish Voice for Peace led a major sit-in protest inside Trump Tower to call for the release of detained Palestinian activist, recent Columbia University graduate Mahmoud Khalil. Those arrested include Jewish elders, descendants of Holocaust survivors, and students. Demonstrators donned red T-shirts with the message, "Jews say stop arming Israel," as they took over the lobby of the Manhattan skyscraper. This is Nate Cohen, a member of Jewish Voice for Peace, speaking outside Trump Tower.
We know that fascist regimes try these things. They test these cases. They try to see if people will comply, if people will roll over and allow them to force this kind of illegal, undemocratic activity on us. And we believe that it's deeply important to stand up in these kinds of moments to say that we will not sit idly by, we will not comply. Never again means right now, never again means for everyone. What happened to Mahmoud should never have happened, and we're not going to let it happen to anyone else.
We'll go to that protest where President Trump first announced his candidacy in 2015 after headlines. Also Thursday, the Council on American Islamic Relations filed a new lawsuit on behalf of Mahmoud Khalil and other Columbia students against Columbia University and a U.S. House committee for respectively disclosing and requesting student records. A lawyer for CARE said, quote, no student should fear that their private information will be handed over to politicians who seek to punish advocacy for Palestinian human rights, unquote. This all came as Columbia announced it had expelled, suspended, and revoked the diplomas of a number of students who took part in a campus anti-war protest last spring. The protest saw students take over a school building and rename it Hinz Hall in honor of Hind Rajab, a six-year-old girl killed by Israeli soldiers in Gaza, along with her family. Also on Thursday, the Trump administration issued a letter to Colombia demanding a list of immediate next steps in order to open discussions on restoring $400 million in government funding that was rescinded less than a week ago. The steps include banning face masks, ramping up its law enforcement authority, and placing the Middle East, South Asian, and African Studies Department under academic receivership or external oversight. In other related news, Harvard law students overwhelmingly passed a referendum calling on Harvard to divest its more than $50 billion endowment from, quote, weapons, surveillance technology, and other companies aiding violations of international humanitarian law, including Israel's genocide in Gaza and its ongoing illegal occupation of Palestine, unquote. Moscow said President Trump and Putin will discuss on the phone a possible 30-day ceasefire in Russia's war on Ukraine, following Russian talks with the U.S. Special Envoy Steve Witkoff. On Thursday, Vladimir Putin signaled he's open to a truce proposal as he listed a series of conditions and concerns around ending the Russian invasion of Ukraine.
But who will give orders to cease hostilities? And what will be the price of such orders? Do you imagine almost 2,000 kilometers of front line? Who will figure out who and when in the field of 2,000 kilometers had broken the ceasefire? And then who will blame who in violation of this agreement?
Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky accused Putin of manipulation, explaining, quote, Putin often does this. He does not say no directly, but he does it in such a way that only delays and makes normal decisions impossible, unquote. NBC News is reporting President Trump has directed the Pentagon to develop proposals to advance his threats to seize the Panama Canal. The U.S. Southern Command's reportedly drafting potential plans to increase U.S. military presence in Panama and partner more closely with Panamanian forces in an attempt to diminish China's influence and cut off its access to ports in the Panama Canal. NBC News report is based on the accounts of two U.S. officials. Panamanian officials responded saying, quote, Our sovereignty over the Panama Canal is absolute and not the basis of any negotiation, unquote. The Panama Canal Authority is run entirely by the Panamanian government, not China, as Trump has falsely claimed. Meanwhile, Trump was asked about his threats to annex Greenland during an Oval Office meeting with the NATO Secretary General, Mark Rutte. Trump's reply, quote, I think it will happen, unquote. During their meeting, Rutte praised Trump and vowed to keep rallying NATO members to increase military spending. Syria's transitional president, Ahmed al-Shara, signed a temporary constitution Thursday, declared the start of a new history for Syria. Ahmed al-Shara, who led the rebel offensive that toppled Bashar al-Assad in December, said the new constitution maintains Islamic law and that the head of the state must be Muslim, as well as enshrining rights of women, the press, and freedom of expression. The document signing came as Israel launched airstrikes on the capital, Damascus. Israel's defense minister threatened to occupy parts of Syria for an unlimited period after deploying its troops following Assad's fall. Meanwhile, the UN warns entire families have been killed in recent sectarian attacks in Syria's coastal region, which is home to the Alawite community. Many have fled across the border to Lebanon, seeking safety.
We stayed at home. We didn't go out. We didn't even stand in front of the windows. We shut the curtains, and we didn't go out at all. All the doors were locked, but we haven't slept for 3 nights. Gunshots. A lot of them. A lot of gunshots. We're not accustomed to that. May God help us.
Argentina's far-right security minister is facing mounting calls to resign over the violent police response to a protest against President Javier Milei's austerity measures and worsening poverty. Over 1,000 riot police were deployed to the streets of Buenos Aires Wednesday in an attempt to crack down on protesters who were tear-gassed and shot with rubber bullets and water cannons. A photographer was left in a coma. Recent protests have been led by retirees who are demanding secure pensions and access to free medications. Cuba's released 553 prisoners despite the collapse of an agreement with the United States that would have seen the easing of sanctions on the island. The deal with the Biden administration was brokered by the Vatican and came to light in January when President Biden announced he'd lift the state sponsor of terrorism designation for Cuba. The measure was quickly reversed by Trump after his inauguration. In related news, the Trump administration's reportedly considering including Cuba and Haiti on a list of countries that could be subjected to a sweeping new travel ban. In other immigration news, the Trump administration's resumed placing asylum-seeking families in detention, restarting a practice that caused the death of at least 6 migrant children during Trump's first term. The nonprofit group Raices is reporting at least 14 immigrant families, some with children as young as a year old, are currently jailed at a facility in Karnes County, Texas, after being apprehended near the Mexican-Canadian borders. The families are from Colombia, Romania, Iran, Angola, Russia, Armenia, Turkey, and Brazil. Family detention had been largely suspended, though not abolished, under the Biden administration. The facility where the families are being held is run by the private company Geo Group, which has been repeatedly accused of abuse, including medical neglect. This comes as the Justice Department has dropped a Biden-era sexual abuse lawsuit against Southwest Key, the largest provider of housing for unaccompanied immigrant children. The move comes after the Health and Human Services Department said it had stopped contracting Southwest Key services. Survivors of abuse said workers forced children to perform sexual acts and pose for nude photos while threatening them with retaliation. And longtime Democratic Congress member Raul Grijalva died Thursday from complications from cancer treatment. For decades, Grijalva represented Arizona's 7th Congressional District, a vast border region that included his hometown of Tucson. He was a leading progressive voice who championed immigrant rights and environmental justice. Grijalva was the longest-serving co-chair of the Congressional Progressive Caucus and a member of the Congressional Hispanic Caucus. Grijalva's father immigrated from Mexico through the Bracero program, which allowed agricultural workers to temporarily come to the U.S. between the early 40s and 60s. Democracy Now! Spoke to Congressmember Grijalva in 2017, just days before Trump was inaugurated for his first term.
When the public comes into the discussion, when they are part of it, when they put that kind of pressure on, and that's part of the strategy that I think going forward is so important. Those of us that are in Congress that are opposed to what's going on are a voice. But the real power in holding back some of the worst instincts of Trump and the majority in the House and in the Senate is going to come from people themselves.
Arizona will have to hold special elections to pick Raul Grijalva's successor. And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. Mahmoud Khalil, the Columbia University graduate and protest leader being held in ICE detention, felt like he was being kidnapped when he was arrested last week and flown to Louisiana, shackled and in handcuffs by agents who never identified themselves. That's according to an updated lawsuit filed by Khalil's legal team late Thursday. They say his treatment by federal authorities reminded Khalil, who's Palestinian and grew up in Syria, of the time he left Syria in 2013 when his friends were being forcibly disappeared by the Assad regime. Less than a week after immigration authorities detained Khalil, Department of Homeland Security, or DHS agents, were back on Columbia University's campus late Thursday to serve two search warrants. Columbia's interim president said no one was arrested or detained and that the university was obligated to comply with the warrants. Earlier on Thursday, the Trump administration sent a letter to Columbia with a list of required policy changes it must meet by March 20th in order to begin negotiations to reinstate the $400 million in federal funding the federal government canceled last week over alleged inaction in addressing what they called anti-Semitism. The letter outlines nine preconditions the university must comply with. These include disciplining students involved in Gaza solidarity protests last spring with expulsion or more severe suspension, turning campus safety officers into police, adopting a definition of anti-Semitism that could limit criticism of Israel, and taking over the Department of Middle East, South Asian and African Studies. In a post on social media, the retired Columbia law professor, Catherine Frankie, described the letter as a ransom note. Before news of the letter was revealed, Columbia's administration announced a range of punishments affecting at least 22 students involved in the occupation of a campus building last spring. The students were expelled, suspended for several years, or had their degrees temporarily revoked. Meanwhile, opposition to the Trump administration's attempt to deport Mahmoud Khalil is only growing. Here in New York, Jewish Voice for Peace organized a nonviolent civil disobedience Thursday in the lobby of the Trump Tower, right by the golden escalator where Donald Trump famously descended as he first announced his decision to run for president back in 2015. Some 300 protesters flooded the Trump Tower lobby, demanding the immediate release of Mahmoud Khalil. Nearly 100 protesters were arrested and faced charges of trespassing, obstruction, and resisting arrest. Democracy Now! Was at the protest.
We're here at Trump Tower, where hundreds of protesters have gathered unfurling banners that say, Jews say do not comply. Than ever. People are protesting, saying, we've got your back. Students, we've got your back. Mahmoud, we've got your back. Gaza, we've got your back. Trans people, and more. The police are beginning to move in. Those who don't want to be arrested have gone up the escalator. We'll see what happens. We're in the middle of Trump Tower here in Midtown Manhattan.
My name's Elena Stein. I'm with Jewish Voice for Peace. We're here today with 300 Jewish people and friends, all of whom are taking the day off work to occupy, to take over Trump Tower, because we know that Mahmoud's case is a pressure test. The Trump administration wants to know if they can crush dissent altogether. So it's Mahmoud's case. He's been abducted, but they're coming for so many more people. They're starting with non-citizen students. They'll move to the whole movement for Palestinian liberation, and they'll do that as a gateway to get to the whole, move all of our movements. And so the time is now. We need everybody to stand up as loudly as possible and ensure that this case cannot go through for all of our movements.
No more deportation and de-occupation. I'm Jay Saper with Jewish Voice for Peace, and I'm here to raise my voice to free Mahmoud Khalil. We see that the president is taking action in our name, and we refuse. We see this is a chilling of dissent, and we understand when you come for one, you must face us all. As Jews, we have an experience with fascism, and our tradition teaches us that we must fight against fascism. So that is why we are rising up right now at Trump Tower to challenge the president's disappearing, kidnapping, abduction of Mahmoud Khalil. I have members of my family who were killed at Auschwitz in the Holocaust, and so I am deeply compelled by my family's story to do everything I can to take action for all of our communities that are under attack right now. This has absolutely nothing to do about Jewish safety, and we will continue to raise our voices when they are talking about taking action against anti-Semitism. That is not the case. What they are doing is stifling the movement for Palestinian liberation, and as Jews, we are calling for the U.S. to stop arming Israel, because we believe our liberation is intertwined with one another, and none of us can be safe until all of us are safe.
Never again for anyone, never again is now.
I'm Jane Hirschman, Britain, with Jewish Voice for Peace, and we're here to say to President Trump, he's got to stop authoritarianism, this fascism. I personally know about it. My parents were Holocaust survivors. My grandfather and uncle were abducted late at night, just like Mahmoud, just the same, and they were taken to jail. And my mother had to find them and get them out. Once they come for one of us, they're going to come for all of us. And we are here to say to Trump, no. And we are Jewish. We're here strong. There are over 216 of us. And this is a message we want to send to the president.
To Mexico, all the walls have got to go.
My name is Josh Dubnow. I'm here as a Jew because I refuse to allow this administration to speak in my name, to use our names as Jews, to carry out a fascist agenda. There is a long history of Jews fighting fascism. And we are here today as Jews and allies to say no to fascism. The Trump administration is a government that has far-right white supremacists, people that do the Nazi salute, and he's fine with that. He's fine with supporting the AfD in Germany and other neo-Nazi and far-right groups. He's not a friend to Jewish people.
The NYPD would like me to communicate that this has been your final warning and they will begin arrests now.
Well, Palestine is under attack. What do we do? Well, Palestine is under attack. What do we do?
I'm a militant anti-Zionist Jew. I'm ashamed.
You guys have to leave here.
Jamal Bowman, former congressman from New York's 16th District. I love showing up here to support people who are putting their bodies on the line to save our democracy. Honestly, I didn't even know this was happening. I happened to be in a neighborhood, and someone told me there's a protest happening at Trump Tower. So I walked over here to just offer my support. I'm here fighting for democracy, fighting for justice, fighting for humanity, fighting for brother Mahmoud Khalil, who was unlawfully detained in our country that's supposed to be a country that exercises First Amendment rights. Brother Khalil was a peaceful protester fighting against the genocide in Gaza, like millions across the country and millions around the world. We have to stand up and fight for him, and we have to stand up and fight for everything this democracy is supposed to stand for. We have a fascist, right-wing dictator in the White House. His henchman, Elon Musk, is a Nazi, and we need the people of our country to push back and fight back and stand up against all of the injustices and the inhumanity that's taking place in our country.
From the river to the sea,
Former New York Congress member Jamal Bowman standing outside the protest where inside Jewish Voice for Peace, hundreds of people gathered at the Trump Tower, where it all began in 2015 when Donald Trump came down the same escalators and first announced he was running for president. About 100 people were arrested. Coming up next, the Russian-American writer M. Gessen, who spent decades writing about autocracy, will talk about Trump's targeting of critics, the rollback of LGBTQ rights, the war in Ukraine, Gaza, and more. Stay with us.
Of all the comrades that I've had, they are sorry for my going away. And of all the sweethearts that I've had, would wish me one more day to stay. But since it falls unto
Parting Glass, performed by Boy Genius. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. As the Trump administration continues to hold Mahmoud Khalil in ICE detention for organizing against Israel's war on Gaza, we turn now to take a broader look at the Trump administration's efforts to chill speech and silence critics. Our next guest has spent decades writing about authoritarianism at home and abroad. We last spoke to the Russian-American writer M. Gessen in December of 2023. At the time, they were in Germany to receive the prestigious Hannah Arendt Prize. But the initial ceremony was postponed after some of the award's sponsors withdrew support over Gessen's comparison in an article of Gaza to the Warsaw Ghetto. Gessen later won a George Polk Award for that article, In the Shadow of the Holocaust, it was called. M. Gessen is the author of numerous books, including Surviving Autocracy. They're also a columnist for The New York Times. M., welcome to Democracy Now! It's great to have you with us.
Thank you, Amy. It's good to be here.
Back in November, you predicted Trump, quote, will likely begin by getting rid of experts, regulators, and other civil servants he sees as superfluous, eliminating jobs that he thinks simply shouldn't exist. You also write in that piece, a major target outside of government will be universities, civil society groups, especially those that serve or advocate for immigrants, formerly incarcerated people, LGBTQ people, women, and vulnerable groups will be attacked. Start off by talking about how you saw all this coming and then the response.
So a couple of things. One was I listened to what Trump was saying, and it was very clear that, well, you know, he kept going on about trans people, about DEI, and about universities. And these were the novelties. His attacks on government as it was constituted before his second term actually date back to his first term. He made it very clear that he doesn't think that government should be constituted in the way it has been. He didn't have the number of people and the expertise and just sort of a sense of how things worked sufficient in his first term to carry out his agenda, but it was made very clear in Project 2025, and even if you didn't read Project 2025, in Trump's speeches, if you listened. So that was one way to understand what was going to happen. Another way was one of my great intellectual inspirations and sources is a Hungarian political scientist, sociologist named Balint Magyar, who has, over the last 15 years, written a lot about ascending autocracies, about mafia states, about what happened in Hungary, and more broadly, what has happened in Europe. And he talked very convincingly to me for that article about getting rid of societies, getting rid of institutions of deliberation, institutions where our obligations to one another are worked out. And I think that that's a really interesting and illuminating prism to look at this through. What it's the way that Elon Musk summed it up in one of his tweets, that empathy is the bane of Western civilization. And really, they do think that. And they see these expressions of empathy, expressions of mutual obligation and mutual interdependence in our institutions. And that's what they're going after. So I think it's very important to understand that they're going after things like Medicaid or Social Security is not an externality. It's not an unintended effect. It's very much what they want to destroy.
You also write about his second term being different from the first, saying during his first term, you could really tell he felt like an accidental president. This time, he seems to feel genuinely chosen. There's a new messianic quality to his behavior. He's not just making deals so he can accumulate wealth while he's president, as he did during his first term. It seems to me he's now planning to rule for a long time, forever in his imagination. He wants to wield genuine power in the world, going to, I mean, just yesterday, meeting with the head of NATO in the Oval Office and talking about, once again, he's going to take Greenland. There's a bill in the Congress now, by the way, to rename it Red, White and Blue Land. And if people think that's just funny and ludicrous, think of AP being banned from the press pool at the White House because they refuse to just say a Gulf of America, as opposed because he renamed the Gulf of Mexico. If you can talk about the significance of all of this, he says he's, yes, reaffirmed he's going to take Greenland, is now told the Pentagon to prepare to take Panama, and talks about, once again, getting rid of the Palestinians in Gaza and rebuilding it for the world's people, he said.
Okay. And don't forget Canada, the 51st state. Which really, you know, I was listening the other day to a bunch of interviews from Canada that The Daily was broadcasting, and I was thinking this sounds so much like the way we used to talk about Russia and Ukraine. By we, I mean Russians and Ukrainians before the invasion. And, you know, there are all these tropes like we're so close, we're practically one people. So many Canadians live, or so many Ukrainians lived in Russia, so many Canadians live in the United States. The border has been porous. We couldn't possibly exist without each other. And at the same time, you know, we're so close, you practically don't exist as a country. It's at once unbelievable and completely real and extremely dangerous. We can't know whether he's going to go after Greenland or Gaza or Canada or Panama Canal first, because he doesn't know what he's going to do first. But I think that we have to believe that he's deadly serious. He's deadly serious about this new imperialist identity for the United States. I mean, not exactly new, but sort of rediscovered. We haven't seen an explicitly expansionist political leader in generations in this country. But it's certainly a thing that exists, and it is particularly a thing that exists among leaders who want to be totalitarian leaders. Imperialism and totalitarianism really go hand in hand. That's axiomatic. And that, I think, is what we're watching. And I think another thing that, you know, we often make this mistake both about political leaders and about ordinary people. We don't notice how much they change. And I think it is important to look at how Trump has been transformed by power, by winning two elections, by winning this last election quite convincingly. Yes, he exaggerates how he won it, but I think that by the margin by which he won it. But I think that the sense that, you know, and all, particularly surviving the assassination attempts, the sense that he is chosen, that he has a mission, that this is something that makes him, sets him completely apart, not just from other people in the United States, but from any other president, any other political leader in the world. These are really important things to look at and to understand that this is a very different phenomenon than we saw during his first term.
So I want to ask you about the Democratic response, which you've also written about. For example, right now you have the Senate Minority Leader Chuck Schumer announcing he's voting for a Republican measure to keep the government funded, splitting from many Democratic senators and Congress members. Now, you write, Trump understands politics as the interplay of power and ideology. His opponents see politics as procedure. The contrast has never been starker. And you write, and never has the Democrats' technocratic, legalistic approach been more detrimental to the cause of democracy. Talk about the span of response, everything from, you know, that golden escalator, which was repurposed yesterday as Jewish Voice for Peace. 100 people got arrested, and they went up and down the escalator, and they decried what's happening with Mahmoud Khalil, with immigrants, with trans people, et cetera. To Schumer.
Right. Well, so I think that we're seeing a real failure on the part of organized politics, on the part of the Democrats. And on the part of the Democrats, the response has really ranged from selective expressions of outrage, if you can call it that, like certainly Congressman Al Green shaking his cane during the Trump's address to Congress. But the rest of the Democrats were sitting there with paddles, right? Which is such, I think they were they probably thought they were being incredibly principled and sending a strong message. But it
and just to be
like
clear, when you say paddles, you mean these little signs that said things like lies, and they would put them up and down.
Right. Quietly, in an orderly fashion. Without risking being removed from the chamber, without, you know, I mean, they could have just sat it out if they wanted to make a strong statement. But this sort of raging takeover, raging nothing will be politics as usual on the right, and this kind of quiet, we're going to stay within the bounds of procedure response on the left, or what we call the left in within Congress, that contrast is so dispiriting to me. You know, and within the Democratic Party, the response has really ranged from we pick our battles to James Carville's article in the New York Times in which he argued for playing dead, literally for playing dead for a year, thinking that Republicans are just going to destroy themselves. And that, I think, is such a huge mistake. And it's probably a mistake that's systemic, that it's a heuristic that is really letting the Democratic Party down. And the heuristic is that they believe that there are going to be midterms. They believe that there's going to be an election in 4 years, that they don't have to defend those basic assumptions, that these things are just going to happen. But we can't take anything for granted anymore.
M. Gessen, I wanted to ask you about the House subcommittee hearing that abruptly ended Tuesday after the Texas Republican Representative Keith Self intentionally misgendered the new Democratic Representative Sarah McBride, the first transgender person to be elected to Congress, by introducing her as Mr. As Chairman McBride delivered remarks, the Democratic Congress member, Bill Keating, interrupted, demanding Self to reintroduce McBride. This was the exchange.
I now recognize the representative from Delaware, Mr. McBride.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Ranking Member Keating, also wonderful.
Mr. Chairman, could you repeat your introduction again, please?
Yes, we have set the standard on the floor of the House, and I'm simply...
What is that standard, Mr. Chairman? Would you repeat what you just said when you introduced a duly elected representative from the United States of America? Please.
I will. The representative from Delaware, Mr. McBride.
Mr. Chairman, you are out of order. Mr. Chairman, have you no decency?
As Congressmember Keating, have you no decency. What hasn't been commented on as much is after Mr. Self introduced McBride as Mr., McBride responded, "Thank you, Madam Chair." But I'm guessing if you can respond to this overall attack on not just trans people, but the overall LGBTQ community, including the national federal website honoring Stonewall, removing the T from LGBT, despite the fact that it was trans women who led the protests that really gave birth to the modern day LGBTQ movement in this country.
Well, first of all, this isn't the first time that this has happened to Representative McBride. She has been the target of systematic, explicit, humiliating, aggressive attacks since she began her term earlier this year. And the fact that we just are watching this as a country and accepting it, not that the sort of television or whatever watching public has much power to stop it, but just being subjected to this spectacle of public humiliation over and over again is something that is so destructive to, I think, everybody's psyche. And I have a piece actually coming out in the Times this weekend talking about this attack on trans people. And it's not an attack on trans rights. It's an attack on trans people, of whom I am one. And I think it's most useful to think of it in the Arendtian framework of denationalization. She argued that before people could be herded to concentration camps and death camps by Nazis, they had to be denationalized, pushed out of the national community, stripped of their, what she called, the right to have rights. Right? We think that we have these rights guaranteed to us because we're born. But in fact, we have rights because we're part of a national community, because courts will enforce these rights, because communities will enforce these rights. And when they're taken away, and they're taken away through a series of both legal and public rhetorical moves, what happens is the Equal Employment Opportunity Commission has dropped cases of anti-trans discrimination, even though there's a Supreme Court decision from 2020 that makes it very clear that trans people are protected by discrimination because they're covered by the clause on the basis of sex. And the Equal Employment Opportunity Commission is basically refusing to enforce the law of the land because trans people have been placed outside the law. Trans people have been receiving, whoever needs to renew their passport, have been receiving passports with the birth sex indicated on them instead of the gender that they've, marker that they've been living with. And I want to make very clear what that is. It's not just an insult when you get this passport in the mail or pick it up from the passport agency. It's a real obstacle to moving through the world, both sort of, on a daily basis, opening bank accounts, applying for loans, applying for financial aids. If you have discordant documents, those are very hard things to do. If you have documents that you're traveling with, whether inside the country or outside the country, that don't match your gender presentation. You know, I was once detained in Russia by an officer who thought that I was a teenage boy. I mean, this was obviously years ago. A teenage boy who was using his mother's driver's license because my driver's license had a woman's name and the gender marker on it. This takes away trans people's right to freedom of movement, one of the fundamental rights of humans, we think. But they're very easy to take away. So that's what we're watching. We're watching the denationalization of a very small, very vulnerable minority group. We've seen in this country already the denationalization of non-citizens. Right? Non-citizens are not members of the political community. Non-citizens don't have the same civil and legal rights as citizens. And now trans people are being put in the same category.
McBride, by the way, actually had a really interesting reply to her accession to the bathroom rule, that the true act of civil disobedience was to occupy the congressional seat, not a toilet seat, and that she wouldn't take the bait, and that she seemed to be living rent-free in the minds of many Republicans. I wanted
she
to,
is brilliant and incredibly brave. Yeah.
I wanted to switch gears for a moment. You mentioned Russia and you're growing up there. And I wanted you to quickly let people know why you left and what happened. But I also wanted you to respond to Moscow saying the latest news now that Presidents Trump and Putin will discuss on the phone a possible 30-day ceasefire in Russia's war on Ukraine following Russian talks with the U.S. Special Envoy Steve Witkoff. Putin signaled he's open to a truce proposal, but listed a series of conditions and concerns around ending the war. Ukrainian President Zelensky accused Putin of manipulation, explaining Putin often does this. He does not say no directly, but he does it in such a way that only delays and makes normal decisions impossible. As we begin to wrap up, your response to what's happening right now around Ukraine?
Well, what's happening right now around Ukraine has been very painful to watch because basically Putin has made his ambition very clear for many years. His ambition is to restore a kind of Yalta world order, one in which the United States and Russia divide the world, carve it up. They have spheres of influence, spheres of domination. He doesn't necessarily want to restore Russian domination over Eastern Europe, but he wants to over the exact same part of Eastern and Central Europe as the Soviet Union dominated, but he definitely wants to divide up the world with Trump with absolute lack of regard for the will of any of the people who live in those European countries, including, but not limited to, Ukraine. Now, the only hope we have here, and this is a very slim hope, is that, yes, indeed, he is clearly stalling. He clearly wants to bite off a lot more of Ukraine than Trump thought going into these negotiations was going to be possible. I watched the inauguration of Donald Trump from Odessa with an Odessa defense analyst whose own apartment was destroyed by a Russian drone a few months ago. And she said that her greatest hope was that Putin would be so recalcitrant that Trump would eventually grow frustrated and start helping Ukraine again. I don't think that's a very likely outcome. But it's also a very desperate kind of hope to think that Trump's propensity for acting vengefully is your country's best hope for survival.
M. Gessen, I want to thank you so much for being with us. Opinion columnist for The New York Times. We'll link to your articles. M. Gessen won a George Polk Award for opinion writing in 2024. They're the author of 11 books, including Surviving Autocracy. Coming up, we speak to a former federal judge about President Trump's escalating attacks on judges who ruled against him. Back in 30 seconds.
Bet it ain't raining back home. Bet your sister's still on the phone. Bet mama's in the kitchen cooking fried chicken, wishing that I hadn't done wrong.
Mama, don't you worry about it none, though. Everything's gonna be all right, Mama. They're teaching us a lot of new things in here, Mama. Things like,
there ain't no good in an evil-hearted woman, and I ain't cut out to be no Jesse Jane, and you don't go writing hot checks down in Mississippi, and there ain't no good chain gang.
There Ain't No Good Chain Gang, performed by Johnny Cash and Waylon Jennings. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman. Two federal judges, one in Maryland, one in California, have ordered the Trump administration to reinstate tens of thousands of fired federal workers. In one of the rulings, District Judge William Alsup said, it's a sad day when our government would fire some good employee and say it was based on performance when they know good and well that's a lie, unquote. The White House responded by saying, quote, the Trump administration will immediately fight back against this absurd and unconstitutional order, unquote. This comes as the White House and its allies have increasingly targeted judges who rule against the administration. Reuters recently reported U.S. marshals have warned federal judges of unusually high threat levels due to a series of comments from Elon Musk, Donald Trump, and others targeting judges. Musk has posted dozens of messages on his social platform X, calling for the impeachment of judges who rule against the administration. He's also called judges corrupt, radical, and evil. Vice President J.D. Vance has questioned whether judges even have the authority to rule on Trump's order. Vance went to Yale Law School. Vance wrote last month on X, judges aren't allowed to control the executive's legitimate power, unquote. President Trump has indicated he believes he's above the law, recently writing, quote, he who saves his country does not violate any law, unquote. Trump has also gone after law firms. Last week, he levied unprecedented penalties against the firm Perkins Coie that has ties to the Democratic Party. On Wednesday, he, a federal judge, partially blocked the order, saying the order, quote, casts a chilling harm of blizzard proportions across the legal profession, unquote. American Bar Association's also criticized efforts to undermine the courts. In a statement, the ABA said, quote, we will not stay silent in the face of efforts to remake the legal profession into something that rewards those who agree with the government and punishes those who do not. We're joined right now by retired federal judge Nancy Gertner. She served as a federal district judge in Massachusetts for 17 years, from 1994 to 2011, now a professor at Harvard Law School. She's also the author of the book In Defense of Women, Memoirs of an Unrepentant Advocate. Judge, welcome to Democracy Now! It's great to have you with us. If you can respond overall to the attack on judges and judges pushing back around the country.
You have to put it in context here. What the judges are doing in cases across the country are dealing with executive orders that are so, so far from lawful, constitutional, consistent with the statute, that frankly, if they didn't respond, there would be something wrong. In other words, there have been, what, over 111 lawsuits filed, and for the most part, every time someone asks for a preliminary injunction or a temporary restraining order, that has been allowed. It does not matter who appointed the judge. It doesn't matter where this is happening in the country. As I said, the distance between what they are trying to do and what is lawful is so enormous that anyone would rule as these judges are doing. The case in California, for example, is a classic example. The judge there yesterday said, you know, give me an explanation as to why the probationary employees have been resoundingly fired. And the Trump administration refused to provide anyone from the Office of Personnel Management. It was as if they were saying, we don't have to explain. We don't have to give an explanation. And the judge was absolutely furious because, of course, there has to be an explanation. These people were fired completely, not following any of the rules, and worse, in order to sort of come up with a lame justification, people who had great performance reviews only, you know, a few months ago were suddenly described as inadequate employees. I mean, it was a contrivance, it was a lie, and it violated, you know, numbers and numbers of laws and statutes. So, judges are doing what they are put on the bench to do, which is to call it as they see it.
Let me ask you your thoughts on Vice President Vance, who notoriously stated judges aren't allowed to control the executive's legitimate power.
Well, I think the word legitimate, carries weight in that sentence. The question is, what's legitimate? And when and courts are supposed to say what the law is. That was settled, you know, in the last century. Courts are supposed to say what is constitutional and what the law is, and the executive is to follow. So they're doing what is completely within their legitimate scope of authority, and he knows that. He knows that. I'm a Yale Law graduate as well, and his statements, frankly, are chilling. Really extraordinary.
Judge,
yeah,
Gertner,
he knows that. But the Yeah.
I want to move on quickly because we don't have much time and there's a lot to talk about. I wanted to get your response to efforts by some House Republicans who've introduced a bill aimed at limiting the power of judges in response to the mounting challenges against Trump's measures and the role of the Supreme Court.
Well, that was to be expected, which is to try to restrict the authority of judges. But the authority of judges to announce what the law is in the Constitution, or is an interpretation of the Constitution, which they cannot undo without undoing much more than just the issue of this judge or that judge. Judges are supposed to interpret the law and particularly interpret constitutional law. And this is a power, it seems to me, that is baked into the Constitution and cannot be taken away. So this is an empty gesture, but even worse, it is a troubling, outrageous gesture.
And can you respond to lawyers for Trump asking the Supreme Court this week to lift a nationwide pause imposed on the president's order ending birthright citizenship for the children of undocumented immigrants, marking the first time the legal wrangling over the president's order to end birthright citizenship has reached the Supreme Court?
Well, this was a move that, in my view, is so far from constitutional that no judge worthy of their name would ever rule in a different direction. Birthright citizenship is in the Constitution. Birthright citizenship was affirmed, 100 years ago. So this is just pushing back on the judiciary. And then when the judiciary does what they don't want them to do, and the judiciary says this is wrong, trying to delegitimize that decision. I can't tell you how fundamentally dangerous all of this is, because the judiciary is one of the institutions that deal with checks and balances. And if you take them out of the picture, you're going the way of Hungary, you're going the way of Russia. And it's extraordinarily troubling.
And can you talk about President Trump simply not obeying the courts? I mean, U.S. Marshals are the kind of army for the courts, but they're under the Justice Department. Trump's Justice Department has the heads of that calling themselves Trump's lawyers.
The marshals are supposed to be the enforcer of judgments. And as you say, they are under the supervision of the Department of Justice. Their authorizing legislation, however, says that the marshals shall enforce the law. And so there's a division here. On the one hand, their authorizing statute says they shall enforce the law. And even if Pam Bondi says, you know, I'm sorry, that law doesn't matter, we're going to skip over that law, they still have an obligation to enforce the law. If they did not, then we would have a constitutional crisis. Saying that doesn't describe what that would mean, a constitutional crisis. What does that mean for all of us? I mean, then it would mean really a marching on Washington, deluging all of the our congressmen and representatives. It could mean mass demonstrations. I mean, it's almost the end of law. And at that point, people have to make it clear, as the population in Israel did, as populations in Poland did, that this is beyond the pale. This is not what our Constitution was meant to accomplish.
Judge, would you call DOJ's taking over federal agencies, you know, run by, as President Trump keeps saying, Elon Musk, the richest man in the world who gave the most money to the president to be reelected? Would you call what's happened as judges push back across the country and say tens of thousands of workers have to be reinstated? Would you call what has happened a coup?
What has happened with Elon Musk? Well, I have called it a coup. If it succeeds, it will have been a coup. In other words, if the definition of a coup is a small group of people who are not elected, and there was Musk, who are taking over the power of the government, yes, I would call it a coup. There are challenges around the country to his authority, to Musk's authority, Musk, who is not confirmed by Congress, who was selected by means that no one exactly knows, who was given powers that no one knows about, who is getting access to information that only government officials who have been appropriately selected can get. And if he's successful in that, there are challenges to that. If he is successful, yes, I would call that a coup.
We're going to leave it there. I want to thank you so much for being with us. Retired Judge Nancy Gertner, professor at Harvard Law School, served as a federal judge in the District Court of Massachusetts for 17 years, speaking to us from Massachusetts. That does it for our show. Democracy Now! Is produced with Mike Burke, Renee Feldstein, Nick Guzder, Messiah Rhodes, Naomi Sheikh, Maria Tarasena, Tammy Warrenoff, Tay Marie Astudio, Sam Alkoff, John Hamilton, Ravi Karen, Hani Massoud, Safwat Nizal. Also thanks to